My name is Kathleen Mullen, and this is a session in the series on poetry and prayer called What Do Poets Do, in quotation marks. A lot of other ways that this session could have been named. How does a poem get written? How does a poem come to being? What does a poet be? You know, a lot of other titles you could. But I picked the easiest one. What does a poet do? I'm interested in this because I think that what happens when a poet approaches or understands the coming on of a poem and then accepts that intuition and tries to follow it through so that some actual words in some actual form get put down on the page, I think that that process is akin in many ways to what happens to us when we try to pray. And I'm exploring this myself, mainly from the poetic part of it. I know better what happens when a poem is coming into being than I have consciously articulated what happens when a prayer is coming into being. So that I'm hoping that by looking at the one thing which I do know better and sharing that with you all, then we can perhaps come to some better understanding of how the other thing gets done. Now, it's really only a hunch I have that these two things are connected. And it only comes from something in me that when I say what I need to do in my life, it has to do with making poems and praying. And then instinctively I say those two things may be the same thing for me. It's an instinct, a hunch, an intuition that I'm interested in following out and learning more about. I don't propose to give any lectures at all. I think that what happens in a poem, when the poet invites you into a poem, if you don't enter into that poem with the poet and between you recreate that poem, then nothing has really happened. What's happened is that your eyes have looked over some words on a page, but you have not entered into the experience of making, of naming, of getting to the heart of things that any poem is all about. And so, I'd like us to make this session itself a poem. There's a text, something that I have in my mind, something that I've brought from my experience out there in the world that I would like to share with you. But that text is only words and only solipsistic, I suppose, unless you can enter it with me. And then as together we can talk about it and recreate or really create, because I have no idea what the ending of this session or this poem, will be. Robert Frost once said that a poem must never lose its sense of a meaning which once unfolded by surprise as it went. A poem must never lose its sense of a meaning that once unfolded by surprise as it went. The end of the poem surprises the poet, and that sense has to stay throughout the whole poem for it really to be a poem. I thought I would do several things. First of all, I've chosen a poem that I like particularly by Lawrence Ferwin Getty from the Coney Island of the Mind, and one from E.E. Cummings, both of which talk about poems and poets. And each of these poets tries to capsulize, tries to express what a poet is, what a poet does when he or she is poeming. After that, I've brought a couple of small lyric poems that I've written and am in the process of trying to make better, so that you can kind of see something that's come out of me and perhaps ask about them, so that I can say from my own experience what did happen in the making of this poem, in the shaping of this poem, where the poem might be going. And then finally, I've got a couple of techniques that might be useful to you if you're interested in trying to get some poetry started in your head. See, it's much, much more than, gee, this is a great poem, let me see why it is. When you're here, I mean, I hope that we'll be involved in something that may lead you to experience firsthand what a poet does in putting words down on the page. I don't really believe anybody learns anything unless there is some kind of direct experience. And you won't know what a poet does until you put yourself in that person's shoes and try to do it yourself. So that's what you're in for this evening. If anybody's having second thoughts, you're welcome to stay or to go. The first poem that I've chosen for you is one from A Coney Island of the Mind by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I'm asking you to do a difficult thing, that is, really to listen to a poem and to have some responses to that poem. Poetry is very dense and packed kind of language. It's hard to hear, it's hard to respond to if you only have your ears. If you saw it on the page, you might feel it, experiencing it in a different way. But I'm asking you to do something that E.E. Cummings says, now the ears of my ears are open. So I'm asking you to listen with the ears of your ears. Okay? I'll read the poem slowly, and I want, as I read it, for you to listen to any one of several things that might catch your attention. The rhythms of the poem, how the poem kind of spreads itself out in the air. The images of the poem, what pictures do you see very vividly as the poet unfolds his idea. The connections in the poem. One of the ways poets build poems is by what I call recurrences, things that they do over and over again. Sometimes, as with a refrain, it's a direct repetition of the same idea in the same words. Other times, it's a recurrence. It's a kind of a repetition, but not exactly. Something that associates with the original idea. So, listen for rhythms, if you like, if that attracts you. Listen for images or particular words that draw you in the poem. Listen for things that might be connected with one another as the poem unfolds. Constantly risking absurdity and death whenever he performs above the heads of his audience, the poet, like an acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making, and, balancing on I-beams above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing entrechats and sleight of foot tricks, and other high theatrics, and all without mistaking anything for what it may not be. For he's the super realist who must perforce perceive taut truth before the taking of each stance or step in his supposed advance toward that still higher perch where beauty stands and waits with gravity to start her death-defying leap. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not catch her fair eternal form spread-eagled in the empty air of existence. Were the ears of your ears open? Kind of took it all in with one gulp. How many breaths did it take? It took me at least four, I think, four pieces. Any responses to the poem?
It moves.
It moves, all right. How does it move?
The words, the verbs take you along. I mean, you identify with, mm-hmm. with the subject.
Okay, that's what's making it move. But how does it move? If you had to get up and perform this poem.
Moves upward.
It moves upward. All right, good. It moves upward. How else does it move?
It soars.
It sways.
Yes,
all right.
Rhythm,
it sways.
Yeah.
Why does it sway?
Tight wire.
It's a tight wire, precisely. Okay. And this is, what is the poet like? He gives us several different words to describe the poet. Like he's an acrobat. And what else do you see the poet being? in the poem.
Daredevil.
A daredevil.
Yeah.
A daredevil. Yeah. That's curious.
A clown or a, I mean.
Okay, all right. Where does that idea come from? Clown.
Charlie Chaplin.
The very end of the poem. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man. I love the way the phrase goes. I mean, it's a little Charlie Chaplin man. Okay? Not a very bold acrobat in shimmering tights who's sure he's going to catch the lady by the wrists.
There's a sense in which that brings in the lightness, so that it's not as heavy as it seemed to be at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because why? That was a shift. Charlie Chaplin doesn't seem to have the power that you thought.
He shifts some acrobatics to Charlie Chaplin, who's always tripping on something.
Wonderful. Okay, good. Okay, and well, what other words does he use to describe the poet in this poem? Let me do it for you quickly once again and kind of listen to your ears. I won't be dramatic this time. Constantly risking absurdity and death whenever he performs above the heads of his audience, the poet, like an acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making and, balancing on I-beams above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing ultra shots and sleight of foot tricks and other high theatrics, and all without mistaking anything for what it may not be. For he's the super realist who must perforce perceive taut truth before the taking of each stance or step in his supposed advance toward that still higher perch where beauty stands and waits with gravity to start her death-defying leap. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man who may or may not catch her fair eternal form spread-eagled in the empty air of existence. Okay, what other images do we have for the poet there?
Realist.
Okay, he's a super realist. Okay, and notice how the poet does it. He's a super realist who must perforce perceive taut truth. Notice the pairings of the strong words in the same syllables, I mean the same letters right there. It's a super realist.
And at the beginning, above the heads of the...
A lot of poets feel that. They are performing above the heads of their audience. Okay, but are the audiences necessary for the poet?
No.
Well, yes and no. Give me the no, then. Why is the audience not necessary for the poet?
He has to follow his own vision.
Right, he has to follow his own vision. It climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making, right? That's his vision, and he's trying to get to the other side of day while he's dancing around there on the high wire. But why is the audience necessary?
He's trying to communicate, so that assumes.
This is not a verbal poem at all. We don't see the poet saying anything to the audience at all. What's the relationship between the poet and the audience? He's performing above their heads, and... That other one that I like so much, and balancing on I-beams.
Why did he bring an I-beam? Because that's not like a high wire. That's a solid thing.
Well, I think the image that he's trying to work there is, where do you look when the high wire artist is performing? Up, okay?
Yeah.
And those I-beams that we direct toward the poet.
EYE.
I'm sorry. EYE. I beams.
I think you're talking about a balance beam.
I'm sorry. Now that's one reason why you really do have to see the poem.
I beams. Okay.
By the way, you should look at the poem on the page, because typography and the way the poet arranges things is often very important for getting his whole idea.
I have a very good friend that wrote Humanities Through the Arts, and he was talking about poetry. He's a professor of humanity, Bucknell. And there's a man that wrote a poem about a falling leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the poem is written like this.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's this man, the one that I will read
is
next
that this
to
man?
Yes, that's E.E. Cummings. A leaf falls loneliness is the name of the poem. And every element of that poem has either a one or the word one, or an I, or something in it. It's a wonderful poem. Maybe it's in here. You can take a look at it later. Okay.
I'll tell you what I thought. I thought you were going to end the poem, and not that the ending was a surprise. I thought when he reached the soaring heights, and then all of a sudden I thought that's what.
Okay. You thought that we were going to end up there with
the soaring heights of beauty.
Big performance, okay, and the poet and beauty would be kind of reconciled up there in the air, and everything would be all happy, but. It's not so much.
I thought that's what it's going to
be. The Charlie Chaplin man comes in. And what does the poet, the little Charlie Chaplin man, have to try to do? And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Oh, there, beauty. Beauty is standing and waiting with gravity. To start her death-defying leap. Mm-hmm. Okay, so beauty's up there. And we might have thought that the poet and beauty would be reunited and all would be well. What's beauty doing up there?
I thought that was going to end with a death-defying leap, period. In other words, beauty can be destroyed quickly.
Yes. And what's the only salvation for beauty in this poem?
It's
the little Charlie Chaplin man, the poet, who may catch her fair eternal form, which is spread-eagled in the empty air of existence. There's not a foregone conclusion to this poem. This poem is always happening because the little Charlie Chaplin man may or may not catch.
Expressing his doubts.
Yeah, all right. His own insecurities and his own insufficiencies. A regular fellow who knows what he's after, who knows what he's doing. I mean, he does have expertise, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, wouldn't be up there on a high wire of his own making, climbing on rhyme and balancing on EYE beams if he weren't some kind of circus performer anyway. Now, there's always the question about whether this guy's performing with Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey or some two-bit circus that just goes around to the little towns. And lots of poets are like that too. My high wire's about that high and I go to very podunk towns in my poems. But, you know, that's another question entirely. But, I think one of the important words in this poem is the word catch. Anybody else resonate to that word? Who may or may not catch her fair eternal form spread-eagled in the empty air of existence.
Yeah, it's as if the poet is not the creator, really. But as a co-creator or a participant in the process that is beyond the poet.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Catch.
Something that is beyond
him.
Is good.
Something that already is almost without the poet.
He's important in the process.
He's essential in the process.
Essential.
Why is he essential in the process of catching beauty's fair eternal form? What?
Well, he's important
for the
rest of us.
It's okay, after all, we don't walk tight ropes and high wires. The other thing why he's essential in it is if he doesn't catch beauty's fair eternal form, what's going to happen to her? Wow, she's going to fall, all right? In that moment of beauty, that moment of death defiance, which is what the poet really is all about, and so is prayer, I think, in some ways, if he doesn't catch that, then it's lost. It's gone forever. I mean, that whole catch. Does catch take a long time? Catch takes that. Okay. Catch takes an instant.
The paradox of measured discipline and spontaneity.
Is
there.
Yes.
Which is also true in prayer, creative prayer.
Look, that's a nice image to pick up. He's got to know something. He's got to have expertise and daring. He's got to know what he's after. But it all happens somewhere out there, and all he has to do is catch it. One of the little cards in the bookstore says that God's creation is out there, makes us appreciate him, that we can see us. Makes us appreciate his goodness. That we can see it makes us appreciate his mercy. And I think, in a way, that's a lot of what the poet is about, too. Gerard Manley Hopkins has a poem which ends this way. has been talking about all of the beautiful things out there. And he says, these things were here, and but the beholder wanting, which two, when they once meet, the heart rears wings bold and bolder, and hurls for him, oh, half hurls earth for him off under his feet. It's just, it's a tremendous coming together with the grace of perception and the goodness of the event of creation as they come together. I think that's got a lot to do with prayer as well. Okay, so that's one image of the poet. Anybody got something? We've got some great stuff to say about him from there. Anybody got a final thing to say about the poet from this poem? The poem is a light poem, is it not? Mm-hmm. It's all about being up there in the air. And yet we've got that element of gravity in there. This is an essential work, a very serious work, because it's up to the poet to save beauty from death. And at every moment it's up to the poet to save beauty from death. And yet the poem, as you told me, moves in a very light and swinging kind of way. The poem that I've chosen from E.E. Cummings is a much denser poem, much more compressed poem. He's talking ideas, he's talking high philosophical ideas, but he's giving it to us in images that we can see. Just for your own curiosity, look at the way the poem looks on the page. Okay, it's this one. It's very foursquare. It's actually a sonnet in its form, although his rhyme scheme is not exactly like Shakespeare's, but that's all right. Cummings did a lot of things differently. He begins right heavy stuff right from the very beginning. He says, no man, if men are gods, but if gods must be men, the sometimes only man is this, most common, for each anguish is his grief, and for his joy is more than joy, most rare. A fiend, if fiends speak truth. If angels burn by their own generous, completely light, an angel. Or, as various worlds he'll spurn, rather than fail immeasurable fate, coward, clown, traitor, idiot, dreamer, beast. Such was a poet, and shall be, and is, who'll solve the depths of horror to defend a sunbeam's architecture with his life, or carve immortal jungles of despair to hold a mountain's heartbeat in his hand. Wow. Heavy, right? This poem does not go. How does this poem go?
Boom.
All right, make some more gestures. How else does this poem go in your head?
March.
Marches on. How does it go in your hands? How does this poem go?
I don't know. I was stuck at the men at the beginning and thinking about language, so.
Oh, you were thinking about the language of it. Okay, well, the language is definitely a thing to think about in this poem. Yeah. Anybody just have some reactions to it? First responses.
My first response is I need to read it myself.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Depressing.
It's depressing?
Wow. Looking at the words, beast and fiends and...
Right.
What about
right.
Heartbeats of mountains? I mean,
yeah, okay. What else? We've got the mountain's heartbeat at the end, and what else do we have at the end to somewhat lighten this?
Oh, he says something about protecting the beauty or something.
Well, he says he's going to defend the sunbeam's architecture with his life. Okay. Now notice where those two things come in the poem. Not until the very end. Okay. And as a matter of fact, we don't even know why he's making this poem. Where does the bit about the poet come?
Very end.
Almost toward the very end. It's the fifth line from the bottom. Such was a poet and shall be and is. And then finally we can go back and say, oh, that's what he was talking about. But we have 9 lines of the poem, which are this dense, almost depressing.
Despair.
Yeah, well, there is a certain amount of despair. Yeah, he says, no man, if men are gods. So we aren't divine, guys. The poet is not divine. But if gods must be men, if there is incarnation, the sometimes only man is this. And what is he? He is most common, just like all the rest of us. For each anguish is his grief. And for his joy is more than joy, most rare. So that's what a poet is. A poet is also a fiend, if fiends speak truth. And if angels are defined as if angels burn by their own generous, completely light. He's talking about a medieval kind of notion there, that the angelic presence, whatever essence, whatever that is a complete and consuming giving. The angel is a total, complete giver. And that's all that the angel's existence is. If angels burn by their own generous, completely light, then the poet is an angel. Or, as various worlds he'll spurn, rather than fail immeasurable fate, poet has a sense that he is called to do this thing. And so in order to do that thing, he's got to spurn various worlds. Now look at the compression that he's got there. Coward, he will spurn the world of brave men. Clown, spurn the world of sober, rational people. Traitor, spurn the world of patriot. We have poets who have spurned the worlds of patriots. Idiot, even of a rational man. Dreamer, not a realist, not somebody who gets things done in the world. And even a beast. He will spurn the world of humanity in order to experience the world of beastliness, if that is what his immeasurable fate calls him to. Such was a poet, and shall be, and is. And then, in order to get to that sunbeam's architecture, he will solve the depths of horror to defend the sunbeam's architecture with his life. And carve immortal, unending jungles of despair. For what? To hold the mountain's heartbeat in his hand. Does Ferlinghetti agree with Cummings about these poets? Is the poetic vocation similar in both of these? Now, that's a hard question to start with. Maybe we ought to start with the poem again, with just that poem. Now, on that second read-through and listen-through, is there anything else that strikes you about this poet?
You get a sense of just the work. I mean, it's really hard work.
Okay, all right, good. And unrelenting.
Okay. Which, in a sense, doesn't seem to go with, like, catching the mountain's heartbeat. I mean, there's a real contrast there. The hard work to get something that seems so, I'd say, light and airy or whatever.
And what's that like? That contrast between
it's a paradox. I would think my sense was that right from the very beginning, he is saying something about, you know, I don't know, from a Christian context, about incarnation and about the willingness for identification with anything in order to do what he is driven or called or moved to do or be.
I was hearing in that the same paradox you mentioned before about the paradox between discipline and spontaneity. It's only through the absolute hard work of trying to make a poem that you can catch the mountain's heartbeat or the sunbeam's architecture. Yeats, another one of my favorite poets, has a line that says, a line will take us hours, maybe, yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. So he's in line with what Yeats is talking about here. There's a tremendous amount of work that goes into making a poem. And in the end, all it may do is defend a sunbeam's architecture.
It was like a dancer.
A supremely useless activity in poetry. Like a dancer.
A dancer that has to work so hard and then it makes it look so easy, you know.
Sure, that effective ease.
Yeah.
Is I mean, teaching is the same way. You prepare and prepare and prepare so that you can say, well, as William Butler Yeats says. Or so that you can create the climate in which that will be necessary. Is that true of other people's work as well? In what ways? Some examples. How do we have to work really hard to get something that looks like a toss-up?
We were talking baseball. A good outfielder makes it look absolutely effortless.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Joe DiMaggio, absolutely.
Right.
Or Willie Mays.
Okay. Yep. Okay. All right. Any other examples from your life?
Well, sermons. You know, I mean, you work and work and work, and you get something that's 10 minutes long and it seems so obvious.
or may I suggest dinner parties?
Yeah.
If the hostess does not do all her work beforehand, then simply have it ready to bring in her pretty little dress, you know, it's not a successful dinner party.
Or a famous one, that the London subway system was created by geniuses for fools to understand, and I think that's true. I mean, it's compared to any American subway system or underground system, they're terribly complex, but the English one, anybody can understand. And, what you were talking about, effortless.
To get that spontaneity, to get that effective ease, to get the what?
Simplicity.
Okay, great. Thank you for that word. That's a word that we haven't said that's been missing. Mm-hmm.
Thinking of a line in T.S. Eliot, the condition of complete simplicity costing not less than everything.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Want to say that one again?
The condition of complete simplicity costing not less than everything.
Somebody mentioned in the in Emily White's session, when asked about paradoxes, a phrase that I'm, not being of Lutheran extraction, don't know by heart, but I learned, costly grace. Mm-hmm. In a sense, that's what the poet is after achieving as well. Well, so now, what does a poet do? What does a poet be? How does a poem get made? What have you learned from listening to these two poets try to express in very different ways what their vocation as poet is?
Well, it's like using a springboard in a diving pool. I mean, you use the words and you get to some other place by using these particular words in this particular place. If you didn't have those words, you wouldn't get there. That's what I like about the poem, a poet, and the poetry is it's so compact, instead of having, on and on and on, endless dispositions and everything else. But a poet with a few well-chosen words can, and like we've been listening to with Emily Dickinson too, can just open up whatever word you want to use, vistas or horizons or whatever else, with her or his particular genius, and that's what I like about them.
Okay, words, the well-chosen words.
Right.
Two things I say about poetry is that the poet can make things unmistakable, and the poet can make things unforgettable. Okay. Are there any unmistakable or unforgettable words that you will take back with you from either of these two poems?
This poor guy worrying about whether or not he's going to catch this.
That's an idea. That's an image. Mm-hmm. Are there any words? If the poet, somebody has defined a poem as a machine made of words, in which the words work together to do whatever the machine is supposed to do. I mean, that's rather a facetious definition, I think.
There are three for me. I-beams.
I-beams, all right.
A mountain's heartbeat. And the sunbeams architecture.
Okay. Yes. Well, those are really loaded ones. I mean, he set you up for those. And another way to say that is he earned those. Okay. He took you through something of the experience of the difficulty of being a poet in order to give you the reward of the poetry at the end. He really earned those. Okay. So good. I-beams. Would you have caught that originally if we hadn't talked about the difference between the structural component and the
it wouldn't have been such a strong image.
Mm-hmm. It is a pun, it does, and that's the other thing that poets love to do with words. He loves to make them do two things at once, at least two things at once. Maybe do three or four, it's even better, but at least two things at once. So well-chosen words, words which compress, capture, surprise, hold you in an experience, in there. the easy way to say it is specific words, okay? Words that you, if I, for instance, stand out here and I say, oh, look, and I point out of that window, what are you going to see? Look at that. What do you see? Do you see anything?
Ranch.
Well, you see everything, but you don't see anything, right? Okay, but if I say, oh, look at the nice angles between the, you know, such and so. And then if I say to you specifically, exactly, precisely, what I want you to see, then you will see it. Okay. If I add to that an affective overtone, something that has some feeling dimension bound up into it, then you will not only see it, intellectualize it and know it, but you'll have it in your heart as well. You'll connect, it will connect on a different level with you. I'm seeing some puzzlement in these pretty eyes.
No, I'm just ruminating.
She's ruminating. I like your word. You think poets ruminate?
Yes.
Ruminating has always connected for me with cows.
Right.
Ruminative beasts. The poet is a cow, a ruminative beast. Oh, how about that? The poet is a cow, a ruminative beast.
I gotta start.
And you know, that is one thing that poets do. Frost particularly loved to catch things that other people said and use those. The phrases of people's ordinary conversation. I've got to start. I don't know where. Now, the question is, what does a poet do after he or she hears or sees something, after there is a beginning, after there is a kernel? That's where the work comes in. And that's where the discipline comes in. And that's where the attention comes in and the focus. And all of those, wonderful story about Jack London, self-taught writer, okay? London, in his rooming house, used to have strings of words strung with clothespins across around his mirror and where he used to shave. So he would put up new words there every day and really make them his own. Words that he liked, words that for him had blood and muscle and bone to them, to use in the stories and creating the images that he was interested in creating. I recommend to you a love of words, a passion for words. I think the poet has to have that. Also, just a plain old enjoyment of them, just an ear for them. Do you remember the lady in the some Walt Disney thing, one of the witches in one of the Walt Disney things who went around saying, elbow, pickle relish. The sounds of words are very important. Also. Okay, what else do you know about what a poet does from having heard Ferlinghetti? And works hard. He chooses his words carefully. He looks for words that will take you beyond the words themselves, open some other kind of vista for you. That's a good
something
word.
Something that's kind of ordinary into something special.
Okay, all right, good. A transformation, a kind of a transforming quality of the words, okay? Sometimes he does this through metaphor, which is simply a word for likeness, okay? He recognizes a likeness between one thing and another thing. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, okay, that's a metaphor for the poet. Okay? Just as acrobat is, just as, that's the only other word. Super realist, okay, something. Well, that's more of a description, I think, than a metaphor in there. But a recognition of the likenesses, the hidden likenesses, maybe, sometimes, between things, the unexpected things, juxtapositions, things that you don't ordinarily see together, but all of a sudden they come together. And there is a new kind of reality for you.
A prophet. In the sense of when you mentioned the juxtapositions and surprise, contradiction.
Okay. Seer, a prophet.
Seer.
Mm-hmm.
A risk taker as well.
A risk taker. Okay. Yeah, constantly risking absurdity.
or they use death too, it seems like.
All right. Mm-hmm. He's a risk taking person. And that can mean a lot of different things.
Like he's a warrior.
Is that a W?
Sufferer.
A warrior and a sufferer.
No, W.
A warrior.
Why?
A warrior.
A warrior.
And how do you?
The first guy is, he soars to these heights and then gravity brings him down and then he worries whether he's going to get caught or not. In other words, he's worried about whether his poem is going to be a success or a big flop. Is it going to impress anybody? Are they going to understand it? Are they going to recognize it? Are they going to...
I don't think he's concerned about
that. I don't know. The other guy, he goes through this depths of hell and everything to protect the moonbeam of the architect, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. They suffer the whole time, it sounds like, to get there.
It's time for me to write on the board, but none of these things write. The diagram that John Schramm introduced me to in his talking about gentle justice. He said, up at the top there is word. Over here there is world. Here there is community. And here there is solitude. If the poet is indeed worried about what kind of effect his poem will have in the world, he's in a way more concerned about the community, if it even is a community. I don't even think it's a community. Commercializing thing. If I could only get here. Word. There's nothing in it. Sorry, nothing in it at all. Word. Word, world, community, and solitude. Okay. I think that there are many different ways of organizing what the poet's about by thinking of the relationships between those four words. Word, world, community, and solitude. Where does a poem begin?
The word.
With the word.
In solitude.
Okay, where does it go if it starts with the word?
To the world.
To the world, goes to the world. All right, word to the world. All right, you say it starts in solitude. All right, where does it go from there? It goes to the word. You find the word in your solitude. All right, then where? We got two other components here. Either, both.
It's a circle, though, not a square, so it can start in any place. Yeah.
Well, it can. It really can start in any place. I mean, if we look at the world as that, or the world is everything that is the case, okay? The world is everything that is the case. All that stuff out there, okay? People in the world, the way people relate to one another in the world, events, situations, all of that. The materia poetica, if you will, the stuff out of which poetry is made. The poet begins in solitude to find the word for the world which he has experienced, and then writes this word and gives it to the community. That's one way to look at it as well. You can also say that a poem starts in the world, that it's the world itself which reaches out to the poet and says, speak me. Okay. Then the world itself requires a kind of a word which can be incubated in the poet's mind, in the poet's spirit, in solitude, and moved into community as well. Perhaps it begins in a need of the community. And I came here not knowing that poetry and gentle justice had anything to do with one another. I have had an education in that. And I have learned that sometimes the poet's word begins in the needs of the community, and which he shapes in solitude, in relationship to the world, to give back to the community. As many different poems as there are, as many different poets as there are these different dynamics. But I think the key word here is the dynamic. The poet is not a static person. E.E. Cummings says, always the beautiful answer, which asks the more beautiful question. You think you got it, and then all of a sudden, within that very answer, you've got the more beautiful question speaking itself to you, so that you don't stay still, you keep moving. Now, the poet, I think, has to be a supremely open person, open, vulnerable, if you will, suffering to all of these experiences out there in the world, and the needs that he sees in his community and in himself. At least that, yes.
You're talking, up to this point, you're talking about very serious poets. What about the people, have you ever heard of Richard Armour?
Mm-hmm. He's the one who does the world according to twisted tales from Shakespeare and stuff like that. Yeah.
I was riding on a plane with him in World War II. He was a reserve officer in the Army, and I had just come back from overseas, and the plane was on its way to Corpus Christi. I didn't know who he was. Sitting in front of me, it was not a passenger plane. It was a patrol plane, maybe a patrol plane. He turned to me and said, "Can you think of a good word that rhymes with rose?" And I said, "No. Offhand, I can't. Why?" He said, "Well, I have something I have to write for the Saturday Evening Post." And suddenly it clicked because I've been reading it. And I said, "Wait a minute. What did you say your name was?" He told me, "It's Richard Armour." And here was a man sitting on a plane. Actually, he was going out to Alameda, out to San Francisco. His wife had just had a baby, and he was able to get leave to go out there to see his wife and baby. Here was a man who was doing something that was quite lighthearted. It was talking, the five lines were about his wife. Mm-hmm. What about poets like that?
They have fun. But they, and I would say they also have to see into things and be open to things. Sure, yeah. I mean,
very aware.
One of my favorite ones is Gillette Burgess. I never saw a purple cow. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I never hoped to see one, but I can tell you anyhow, I'd rather see than be one. That's funny. That's lighthearted.
Judging by the milk we get, I'm sure that there must be one.
Oh, right here in our midst berry. In our midst berry, yes.
Well, I grew up in the tropics where we didn't get fresh milk.
Well, I don't think that. I think perhaps, well, what? The obvious thing to say is that there are different visions that animate each poet. I mean, I doubt that Richard Armour would conceive that he had an immeasurable fate, which he had to live up to. I would say that the people who write light verse simply for the sake of entertainment, which, by the way, I don't consider children's verse in the same way as that. I think children's verse is a whole lot more serious than that.
Robert Louis Stevenson.
Has to be informed by some kind of vision, some kind of world view. But even these folks have to know the craft of the poet, to manipulate the craft of the poet. And they also have to know that business about compression, I think, is so important. They really have to know the point at which they will get some kind of response from their audience.
That's the one, you know, on ice breaking. Candy's dandy, but liquor's quicker. That's marvelous compression.
Yeah, absolutely. And rhyme, not to mention
that's right.
Rhyme.
Well, they have to have world view, too.
That's right. But to me, it's like music. I mean, there's light music and there's heavy music.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. true. Yeah.
And I take them both. I enjoy them both.
No.
Qualitatively, as you can't say one thing is better than another in its own fashion. It is a good thing, in its own fashion. It is a good thing. I think the world is much happier for those people who have as they've chosen to write light verse for us.
Of course, that was an avocation with Richard Armour. He taught English at one of the schools down in California. Mm-hmm.
I made a light verse once, would you believe it? Let's see if I can remember it. Gin does me in. It goes to my head and sends me to bed, but better to bed than to sing.
I was going to say better to bed than to sing.
I know, you thought. That's why I didn't make it that way. Sing was the one that I really wanted to sing. Say so. I got a kick out of making that one, but you know, I don't consider that in the same vein as as some of the more serious things that I would like to do. Sometimes we pray lightly. Sometimes we do a lot of things lightly.
Robert Louis Stevenson wrote some fine children's verse, mm-hmm. and yet he was a very tortured man. Mm-hmm. And I've often wondered how he could do this thing, write these kind of poems that we learned in school, and they have never left me. I can recite several of them that I learned when I was in the fourth or fifth grade. I love them, but yet I know this man was tortured mm-hmm. for the most part of his life.
That's one thing I think that the poet or the writer of any kind, is one technique for getting something said. You know how you're feeling, and what you need to do is pretend that you aren't feeling that way. Okay, I think what the poet does for us is give us an imaginative vision. Okay, it shows us alternatives. You know, whether that's very serious alternatives to loss of faith, or alternatives to shyness at a party, or whatever. But that business about behaving as if it weren't, you know, consciously becoming the opposite of the person that you know yourself, you know yourself to be. That may be a way to do it. How much time do we have?
No. It's 20 after 7.
It's 20 after 7, all right? The bell's going to ring in just a little bit. I think I'd rather tell you a couple of the... You know, you're welcome to take these poems with you, if you like. I don't pretend that these are great poems. I am myself a beginning poet. These are not narrative poems. They come from a real range in my life. I wrote some of them when I was 18, and I'm much older than that now. And some of them only more recently. I gathered them together under three kinds of rubrics: morning poems, midday poems, and evening poems. I think that I'm learning how to write poetry better and better. I hope to spend the next year doing that. If you'd like to take them and have them and catch me sometime in the next couple of days and say, well, how did this one get written? I'll be glad to talk with you about
that. Your next new poem, Ruminations in Poetry, started with a word in a community.
Actually, I'm working on one about the deer and the deer eating the flowers. Right now, but let me give you two techniques for stimulating your own creativity that I think may be useful for you. And if you give me a minute, I'll see if I can go snitch a thing that writes.
Dear,
I'm
snitching.
What do I have?
Dear,
oh, really?
Oh.
Fun to watch another one. She's a real girl.
Too much of an engineer.
Okay, these two techniques of clustering and free writing are mechanical techniques which are meant to get through our initial resistances to writing, to try and find some things that are deeper in us than what we think we have to say right on the surface. This clustering is a technique developed by a woman named Gabrielle Rico, and this one, free writing, by a man named Peter Elbow. So I'm giving you Elbow Rico techniques right now. What happens in clustering, it's not a syntactic thing at all. You don't put words together. You simply generate words. You start off, for instance, you're trying to write a letter to somebody about why you want to stay here at Holden. All right, for that. So in the middle of the page, you put Holden down. Okay. Then simply associate. What does Holden make you think of? Draw lines over here. Over here for a different idea. And then, for instance, maybe Holden makes you think of peace. Okay, now, maybe Holden makes you think of green. Maybe it makes you think of people. Okay, those are your first level responses. Now, from here, what else do you think about when you think about peace? What do you associate with green or something like that? The idea is simply to get clusters, which is the name of the technique, clusters of ideas out of you, so that you can see, after having doodled on a page like this for maybe 5 minutes or so, where your mind is attracted. Where is your mind going? Usually when we write, people tell us, get the idea that you want to express, and then find the words for it. This goes entirely the opposite direction. This says, write some things down and see what attracts your mind. See where your mind really wants to go, what's associated in your mind with these ideas. You may, have you ever played that association game? You find yourself thinking about something, and then you say, how did I ever get to thinking about that? And then you work back the train of associations to find what made you start there. It's similar to that, see? And this is all kind of more subconscious responses than on the conscious level. So you end up with a sheet of paper with a lot of different words on it, which are associated, some connected to one another. And then you'll be able, perhaps from there, to move to the next step, which Peter Elbow calls free writing. Suppose you want to take the cluster of things that surround peace for Holden. Okay. So you choose a word out of this cluster that seems to make, I don't know, that attracts you most. And then you just simply write that at the top of the page. Peace. Now, the only rule that free writing has is that you time yourself. You have, say, 5 or 6 minutes to do this with. And you start writing and you keep writing. You don't let your pencil up off the page. Okay, if you can't think of something to write, you write, I can't think of anything to write. What's going on in my... And you'd be surprised at how quickly the next thought can come in here. Now, is this all going to be good? No. Most of it will be junk. And the purpose of the free writing is kind of plowing up to find out what you have in your head. You write this in sentences, you can write this in phrases, you can write it in questions, in words, or whatever, or combination. You'll find yourself writing a combination of these kinds of things. Okay? And then from there, you plow up these ideas that are in your head and begin to find out where your mind wants to go, your words want to go. We're going to do this in a workshop session on, I guess it'll be Friday, if anybody wants to come back and actually work through some of this free writing. And then I have some response techniques that I also can show you about how to share your words with other people.